All through the 13th century, a section of the Franciscans were straining at the rule of the Church, and in 1318, four of them were burnt alive at Marseille as incorrigible heretics. There seems to have been little difference between the teaching and spirit of St. Francis and that of Waldo in the 12th century, the founder of the murdered sect of Waldenses. Both were passionately enthusiastic for the spirit of Jesus of Nazareth, but while Waldo rebelled against the Church, St. Francis did his best to be a good child of the Church, and his comment on the spirit of official Christianity was only implicit. But both were instances of an outbreak of conscience against authority and the ordinary procedure of the Church, and it's plain that in the second instance, as in the first, the Church scented rebellion. A very different character to St. Francis was the Spaniard St. Dominic, 1170-1221, who was, of all things, orthodox. He had a passion for the argumentative conversion of heretics, and he was commissioned by Pope Innocent III to go and preach to the Albigenses. His work went on side by side with the fighting and massacres of the Crusade. Whom Dominic could not convert, Innocent's crusaders slew. Yet his very activities and the recognition and encouragement of his order by the Pope witnessed to the rising tide of discussion and to the persuasion even of the papacy that force was no remedy. In several respects, the development of the Black Friars or Dominicans, the Franciscans were the Grey Friars, shows the Roman Church at the parting of the ways, committing itself more and more deeply to organized dogma, and so to a hopeless conflict with the quickening intelligence and courage of mankind. She whose one duty was to lead chose to compel. The last discourse of St. Dominic to the heretics he had sought to convert is preserved to us. It's a signpost in history. It betrays the fatal exasperation of a man who has lost his faith in the power of truth because his truth has not prevailed. "For many years," he said, "I have exhorted you in vain, with gentleness, preaching, prayer, and weeping, but according to the proverb of my country, where blessing can accomplish nothing, blows may avail. We shall rouse against you princes and prelates, who, alas, will arm nations and kingdoms against this land, and thus blows will avail where blessings and gentleness have been powerless." The 13th century saw the development of a new institution in the Church, the Papal Inquisition. Before this time, it had been customary for the Pope to make occasional inquests or inquiries into heresy in this region or that, but now Innocent III saw in the new order of the Dominicans a powerful instrument of suppression. The Inquisition was organized as a standing inquiry under their direction, and with fire and torment the Church set itself through this instrument to assail and weaken the human conscience in which its sole hope of world dominion resided. Before the 13th century, the penalty of death had been inflicted, but rarely upon heretics and unbelievers. Now, in 100 marketplaces in Europe, the dignitaries of the Church watched the blackened bodies of its antagonists, for the most part poor and insignificant people, burn and stink pitifully, and their own great mission to mankind burn and sink with them into dust and ashes. The beginnings of the Franciscans and the Dominicans were but two among many of the new forces that were arising in Christendom, either to help or shatter the Church, as its own wisdom might decide. Those two orders the Church did assimilate and use, though with a little violence in the case of the former. But the other forces were more frankly disobedient and critical. A century and a half later came Wycliffe, 1320-1384. He was a learned doctor at Oxford. For a time he was Master of Balliol, and he held various livings in the Church. quite late in his life, he began a series of outspoken criticisms of the corruption of the clergy and the unwisdom of the church. He organized a number of poor priests, the Wycliffites, to spread his ideas throughout England, and in order that people should judge between the church and himself, he translated the Bible into English. He was a more learned and far abler man than either St. Francis or St. Dominic. He had supporters in high places and a great following among the people, and though Rome raged against him and ordered his imprisonment, he died a free man, still administering the sacraments as parish priest of Lutterworth. But the black and ancient spirit that was leading the Catholic Church to its destruction wouldn't let his bones rest in his grave. By a decree of the Council of Constance in 1415, his remains were ordered to be dug up and burnt, an order which was carried out at the command of Pope Martin V by Bishop Fleming in 1428. This desecration wasn't the act of some isolated fanatic. It was the official act of the Church. 14th. The history of the papacy is confusing to the general reader because of the multitude and abundance of the popes. They mostly began to reign as old men, and their reigns were short, averaging less than 2 years each. But certain of the popes stand out and supply convenient handles for the student to grasp. Such were Gregory I, 590 to 604, the Great, the first monkish pope, the friend of Benedict, the sender of the English mission. Other noteworthy popes are Leo III, 795 to 816, who crowned Charlemagne, the scandalous popes John XI, 931 to 936, and John XII, 955 to 963, which latter was deposed by the Emperor Otto I and the great Hildebrand, who ended his days as Pope Gregory VII, 1073 to 1085, and who did so much by establishing the celibacy of the clergy and insisting upon the supremacy of the Church over kings and princes to centralize the power of the Church in Rome. There was a great struggle between Hildebrand and the emperor-elect, Henry IV, upon the question of investitures. The emperor attempted to depose the pope. The pope excommunicated the emperor and released his subjects from their allegiance. The emperor was obliged to go in penitence to the pope at Canossa and to await forgiveness for 3 days and nights in the courtyard of the castle, clad in sackcloth and barefooted to the snow. The next pope but one after Gregory VII was Urban II, 1087 to 1099, the pope of the First Crusade. The period from the time of Gregory VII onward for a century and a half was the great period of ambition and effort for the Church. There was a real sustained attempt to unite all Christendom under a purified and reorganized Church. The setting up of Latin kingdoms in Syria and the Holy Land, in religious communion with Rome, after the First Crusade, marked the opening stage of a conquest of Eastern Christianity by Rome that reached its climax during the Latin rule in Constantinople, 1204 to 1261. In 1176, at Venice, the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, Frederick I, knelt to the Pope Alexander III, recognized his spiritual supremacy, and swore fealty to him. But after the death of Alexander III in 1181, the peculiar weakness of the papacy, its liability to fall to old and enfeebled men, became manifest. Five popes tottered to the Lateran to die within the space of 10 years. Only with Innocent III, 1198 to 1216, did another vigorous pope take up the great policy of the City of God. Under Innocent III, the guardian of that Emperor Frederick II, whose career we've already studied, and the five popes who followed him, the Pope of Rome came nearer to being the monarch of a united Christendom than he had ever been before, and was ever to be again. The empire was weakened by internal dissensions, Constantinople was in Latin hands, from Bulgaria to Ireland, and from Norway to Sicily and Jerusalem, the Pope was supreme.